Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. On today's show, you'll hear from singer-songwriter Grace LaChance and documentary filmmakers Michael Palmieri and Donald Mosher on their new film, The Gospel of Eureka. But first, we're going to have a song by Grace LaChance off her debut EP, When Lightning Strikes. This is the song, No Sound.
There's no sound. No sound. No sound. You said stop. I guess I forgot. You think you're the leader, think you're the boss, and everyone should obey your commands. Well, I'm not one of your puppets. I took the strings and you know you've lost it now. Now, ow. The words you're pouring out, they're gonna shape what you're about.
Myself and that's dangerous. Yeah. Careful with my language, cross me once and now we strangers. Possess a strange gift, securing my derangements. Focused on my art and stay focused on my pavement. Floral from the pavement, inheritance, enslavement. Mind running wild, got me wondering where the day went. Yeah, yeah. My vision not for the layman. Really, I prefer no sound to what you say.
The words you're pouring out, they're gonna shape what you're about.
Nothing on my mind but the top.
Yeah. Oh,
all eyes are on me, feeling like pop. Don't need your input, you should stop.
You should stop.
Beast, every time the beat drop, ain't nothing on my mind but the top.
But the top.
Look,
yeah.
You ain't think I win, what a shot. But it's really my time, check the clock. Yeah. Strategic all day with the plots. You think that I'm a break, take your shot.
Take your shot. Yeah.
That was the song No Sound by Grace LaChance off her debut EP, When Lightning Strikes. At only 18 years old, this native of Stittsville, Ontario, has already a star on the indie music scene. At only 15, she was named a winner of the 2015 She's the One contest at Ottawa Blues Fest. In 2016, her emotive cover of Codaline's All I Want earned her the opportunity to team up with Universal Music Canada to release her debut single. That song, Anymore, attracted attention from the Canadian radio industry when she received the Bell Media Rising Star Award and earned 2 number one titles on AC Radio, taking the coveted spot for most added song and futures spot. After that, she teamed up with New York-based producer Julie Catherine to help her on her new project and new vision, and that sort of bond was a great example of the women in music movement as two female artists poured out their energy and soul. She also takes inspiration from songwriters such as Ed Sheeran, and she is constantly expanding her repertoire of relatable songs. She just played 2 shows here in Toronto on Thursday and last night in Ottawa. That was Saturday. So this is my conversation with Grace LaChance. All right. Grace LaChance, hello.
Hi.
How's it going?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Good. Surviving this Toronto weather?
Yes, very much.
So you have an EP release party coming out.
Yes.
For When Lightning Strikes.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to you now that this project is finally, it's reached its completion and you're sending it off into the world?
I'm so excited. It's been, since April, I believe it was done, so it's really great to finally be able to put it out there and for everyone else to hear it because I've been hearing it for so long. I'm really excited about it.
And you've got 2 shows coming up. You've got one tomorrow,
mm-hmm.
Here in Toronto, and then you've got, one on Saturday.
I do.
In Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
The importance of releasing this album in playing these shows in your hometown and an area that you are familiar with,
mm-hmm.
how much will that do you think for you as a performer playing to people that you know?
It's always great, especially just in Ottawa because, you know, it is my hometown and it's a very supportive community as well. So that's always great. And it's awesome coming to Toronto too because the more that I'm here, the more that I'm performing here, the more that I'm able to build more of an audience. So it's great, yeah.
Your most recent video was Strong,
mm-hmm.
that I had a chance to watch. Talk to us a little about that song. Where did that come from for you?
The song itself or the music video?
The song itself.
So that was a song that I did with Julie Catherine. She also produced my EP. She's in New York. And, you know, for my songs, I find they're very spur of the moment. They kind of just come to me whenever I'm, no matter what I'm doing, really. And that was really great to be able to write that song because it kind of, for me, went to prove that it's not conceited to admit to your own strength. It's just, it's kind of a part of growth and development. And yeah, I think it was really great to be able to write that song.
I was intrigued by the music video. Do you have any previous kickboxing or martial arts experience as we saw in the video?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've been doing martial arts since I was 5 or 6. So it's it was great to be able to do that in the video.
Another one that I had to check out was the video for Anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Where did that song originate for you? Same kind of idea as Strong? Or?
That song was less about, I think, self-empowerment and more about my own personal annoyance with passive aggression. So, like, I mean, every song has a different theme to it, has a different tone, message. Anymore was definitely about passive aggression and Strong was more about self-empowerment.
How would you describe your writing process? I know that you've, with a few of the songs, you've taken on co-writers. Mm-hmm. But for you, do you find that you do the lyrics first, or do you always start off with a melody and then add the words later?
It depends every time, but usually the melody first and then the lyrics after. But I have kind of like a song bank, so sometimes, you know, I can kind of just pull lyrics from there and then match them to whatever melody I have going on as well. Yeah.
We've been talking about Ottawa, and you actually got your start because you won a contest back when you were 15 at the Ottawa Blues Fest.
Yeah.
Talk about winning something like that, not only for you as an artist, but in your hometown. What did that do for you?
It was amazing, really. It kind of helped me to get my career started, really. I was playing a lot of local shows and things around Ottawa before then, so I was able to kind of build an audience, but that was the first time that I had an opportunity that was really that big, because it allowed me to put out my first single. So it was amazing.
In your bio here, it says you give a nod to a lot of songwriters. When one mentioned specifically was Ed Sheeran. Mm-hmm. What do you like about him and his style of music, and maybe other musicians of that ilk that influence you a lot?
Yeah, I think it's important, because I think if you just look into one genre, let's say pop, for example, you might miss some really good writers from other genres as well. So there's usually something, you know, it could even be come down to, you know, I might like someone's range from a particular genre, but then I like someone else's songwriting, and it all kind of comes together. For him, he was out even before James Bay and other songwriters, and I think he just has a really great way of conveying whatever message he wants to get across, which I respect.
You mentioned a whole bunch of different artists, and you actually got noticed because of a cover that you did from Codaline, All I Want, which I think got you into Universal. What was it about Codaline and that song that, why did you decide that this was a song that you wanted to put your own take on?
Mm-hmm. I think that, especially with covers, it's really important that if you're going to choose a song that's not your own and it doesn't have your own kind of stamp on it, then you need to make it your own in some way. And picking a song that's sort of fluff, especially as a cover, it doesn't really do anything for me. So I wanted to pick a cover, and I still trying to pick covers where if I'm going to choose them, they have to have something where they're either conveying a really strong emotion, or they have a really important message, or something like that. So that song was really, I think it's emotional, and it conveys a lot of important things. So yeah, that's why I chose it.
I know that the lead single off the album was No Sound. Mm-hmm. And the video for that was released back in December. Mm-hmm. Before the other two. Where did that song come from for you?
No Sound. I think, again, that kind of touches on the same meaning of as Strong, in terms of just the self-empowerment. A lot of this EP has to do with that. And I think it's just, it's important because, you know, whenever, if you're ever feeling like you're being ignored in a situation, or you're being kind of overlooked, that sort of fuels some of my songs, and that feeling of like, oh, wait a second. You know what I mean? So, yeah.
I know on that song, you also got to work with both G Grand, mm-hmm. and Kayla Diamond. Talk about the collaboration part of putting a whole album together, and the experience that you had with featuring another musician on a song of yours.
Yeah. I think when we were in the studio, originally we had it kind of structured where it was my original verse and, well, verses and choruses that I'd written before, and we kind of came to the conclusion that it needed a little bit more of a push, something a little bit more interesting to give it that chance, I guess. And yeah, we took my verse out because I did kind of get across the gist of what I was trying to say in the first verse, and we thought it'd be really cool to have someone else's take on it. And luckily, he was able to kind of capture exactly the way I felt about the song in his own words.
Describe here with yourself, Julie, and Kayla about the women in music mm-hmm. movement that's sort of moving through the scene right now. In terms of your career as an artist and a growth, how important was that for you, not only working with industry professionals, mm-hmm. but women as well, especially in this cultural era that we're in right now?
Extremely important, yeah. I think it's really important, and it was different as well. You know, I've worked with a lot of amazing producers, a lot of great writers, but it was just this natural collaboration where it was just, I think the two of them are just so welcoming to any new ideas, and it was really easy to kind of collaborate and work together. It was like nothing I've really experienced before in the industry. Yeah.
You've sort of released three music videos in quick succession. Mm-hmm. What do you enjoy most about the process of making music videos?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I think it's so easy to look at music and to just go, okay, well, if they're in music, they can sing, they can play an instrument, then that's it. But it's so much more than that, and there's so many other facets to it that go into making a project. And, you know, when I first started doing photo shoots, music videos, I had no idea what I was going to be doing, right? But I ended up really liking it. And I think my favorite part is changed, really, when I realized that it is also a part of the art. It's not just about the music. And being able to express kind of my ideas in relation to what I want the video to be, what I want the concepts to be, is really important.
How much say do you have in the overall construction and the theme of a music video? How closely do you work with your team on that?
Very, very closely. We have meetings and we just discuss the concepts, and I'm able to totally say whatever ideas I'm thinking, and we kind of collaborate and come up with the best of everyone's ideas.
What have you learned most about the business side of the industry since, you know, throughout the process of making this EP?
Yeah, that's actually a really important topic to touch on, I think, because, again, you know, there's so much more to having a career in music than just what's on the surface. And I think you learn a lot. I've learned a lot about the business side of it because, in a sense, you are sort of represented as your own entrepreneur, you know. And you have to market what you want to say, how you want to say it, in a certain way. And I think it allows you to grow a lot as an artist when you kind of touch on the business side as well.
So you have two shows coming up, and I read somewhere that are you going to be doing more tours around southern and eastern Ontario? Is that coming up?
Yeah, hopefully that'll be coming up soon, but I don't have any particular details set in stone on that yet. But I do have those shows coming up this weekend, so I'm looking forward to those.
When you start venturing out outside of Ottawa, Toronto, and you know, into other cities, what are you looking forward to most, or anticipating most about being on the road?
I think that, one, it'll be hopefully really spontaneous, which I love. I'm not someone who needs to have like a set in stone structure or, you know, a schedule that's really, really organized. I can kind of just, I'm okay with doing things spur of the moment. But I'm excited. I hope that when I do go, that there are people that can sort of relate to my music, or even if it's just one lyric in particular. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
Do you have a favorite song off of When Lightning Strikes that you really like?
Ooh, that's a tough question. I think every single song has a different meaning, and I like it for a different reason. Sometimes I'll go through phases where one week, one song of the EP is my favorite, and the next it's a different one. So it's hard to choose, but I think everyone that I have shown the EP to thus far, every single one of them has a different favorite. So it's interesting.
You've finished this EP. Are you already looking at plans for a full album?
I would hope so, but that's not something that's set in stone in the works. But you know, I think we're always looking for what's next, whereas I try to stay really what's happening in the moment, just because, you know, you can kind of get caught up in what's coming next and forget to focus on what's happening now.
What do you make of the Toronto music scene and the Canadian music scene for young indie artists such as yourself? What do you find that community to be like?
I think it's pretty incredible. Canada is really unique. Even just the factor grants that it allows artists to have. Like, we have a community that really supports the arts, which I think is really important because, you know, it's so hard trying to make a career for yourself and try and have time in the studio and all these things if you're just starting out and you haven't made it yet. And I think Canada is really good at supporting those new artists that are coming up in the industry.
Well, you have a show coming up February 7th at the Cameron House, and then another one on February 9th in Ottawa.
Yes.
Grace LaChance, thanks so much for checking out here, making the time, stopping by today.
Thank you for having me.
Cheers. That was my conversation with singer-songwriter Grace LaChance, and now here's another song off her EP When Lightning Strikes. This is the song Mile Too Far.
Thank you. I play along, cause I have to admit, I never really thought we would ever last too long. You were always just a mile too far, only just a little too fast. I tried to catch up to you, but I ended up last. You left me on the curb this time. I finally had to learn what it was like to be left alone.
And that was Mile Too Far by Grace LaChance off her new album, When Lightning Strikes. My next guests are documentary filmmakers whose new film is The Gospel of Eureka. It's a very, very interesting film. It's about a town in Arkansas called Eureka Springs. And it's described as a one-of-a-kind oasis in the Ozarks, where Christian piety rubs shoulders with a thriving queer community. If that wasn't enough, it's narrated by the amazing mix Justin Vivian Bond. And it's a lushly photographed documentary that spotlights the space where the town's seemingly contradictory factions intersect. Lee and Walter, for example, are out and proud husband owners of the local gay bar they liken to a hillbilly Studio 54, and they talk about their deep-seated faith. A Christian t-shirt designer describes his love for his gay father and everything that comes together in a show-stopping matchup of a spectacular passion play and a raucous drag show. The directors, once again, are Michael Palmieri and Donald Mosher, and they say, cinema, like theater, can heighten our belief or make us believe the unbelievable. It can also disrupt and deconstruct our belief. Without condescension, we hope to show that what is crass, campy, or even profane in the eyes of one group is sacred and full of communal significance in the eyes of another. We consider this project a continuation of the cinematic exploration of the links between class, commerce, and American ritual that is central to a work. In an era where fundamentalism in both faith and politics rule the national stage, we hope to present a drama that explores the complex nature of belief and the fluid nature of faith, but also provides personal windows into the issues and problems facing America as a whole. Now, in addition to The Gospel of Eureka, their films have exhibited at major festivals, including Sundance, Tribeca, NYFF, LAFF, True False, Cannes, Locarno, and Leipzig. Their first film, October Country, was the winner of the Silver Dogs Grand Jury Prize for Best Documentary Feature and was nominated for Best Documentary Feature at the Independent Spirit Awards in 2009, playing at festivals around the world, winning numerous awards, including two Cinema Eyes. They were recognized in 2010 by Filmmaker Magazine as one of the 25 new faces of independent film, and their second feature, off-label, was released by Oscilloscope Films in 2012. Their short film work includes the award-winning Rugger-Rowing, a film that explores the ritual of Mardi Gras in Louisiana, and the Field of Vision short film Peace in the Valley, exploring the conflict between evangelicals and the LGBT community in Eureka Springs, which, of course, was expanded into their new film, Gospel of Eureka, which premiered in 2018 at South by Southwest. This is my conversation with Michael Palmieri and Donald Mosher. Michael Palmieri, Donald Mosher, hello. Good afternoon. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks very much for having us.
So, the film is The Gospel of Eureka. How did you two first find out about this interesting little place in the middle of the Ozarks?
We were commissioned by Field of Vision to do a short film concerning the civil liberties ordinance, or the vote over civil protection is happening in Eureka. And once we got there, we realized there was a much larger, much more complicated story about faith happening in that town.
What do you think it says about, you know, given the conversation that's happening in U.S. politics right now and the divide that we see, what does a film like this and a town like Eureka show us about humanity and different viewpoints coexisting side by side?
Well, I guess the answer to your question is part of your question in a way, because, you know, what we found more interesting about the town than this political civil rights ordinance that was being passed is that everyone in the town pretty much is Christian. So you have an LGBTQIA haven in northwest Arkansas that's about 45-50% gay, and per capita a very large trans population especially. But they're Christian. So at the same time, it's a huge evangelical Christian spot. And so at the end of the day, all these people have to sort of get along and live in a town together and negotiate that space together. So it certainly was, we thought, worth highlighting and focusing on, because, you know, we only need to open the paper every day to see division. But I think in reality, it's a little more complicated and a little bit more, in some cases, needs to be more harmonious than the way it's presented.
Well, and I think, you know, on that note about just us opening up the paper and, you know, it's another story about the cultural divide, how much of that is artificial, manufactured, or exaggerated, and how much of that do you think is actually true?
But do you mean in the context of our film?
Yeah, like, because you're yeah, like, what you're showing in Eureka is... It goes against what I guess we've been told by the media and the politicians and stuff. So how in terms of the larger narrative and the conversation that we're having, especially in the media, how much of what we are presented with is perhaps artificial or exaggerated?
I mean, a great deal. I mean, we're living in a time now where the negative image gets the most attention, and also the highlighting divisions among people who are even marginalized and oppressed among them. Anything that can be dividing people who would gather together and have some strength is really downplayed by the dominant narrative, I think, right now. Even the narrative on the left, in a lot of ways. At least a media narrative. You know, I think simplicity and quick hits of information, which then can be shaken out of context easily, those are the popular modes of information passing right now. And, you know, in Eureka still kind of operates on small town, slow southern mode. And that's not without paradoxes and contradictions and conflict. But there's still some other complications and intricacies at work that should, you know, I think, counter the dominant simplified narrative.
How did you two get Justin Vivian Bond involved as the documentary's narrator?
We've known Justin for
a long time. Since San Francisco days, where we used to live.
Yeah, from the you know, basically the Queer Underground in San Francisco. And then they were on the list because of their ability to, you know, their performative abilities are just astounding. And we just wrote to them and they said, yeah. It was very simple, very fast. And it worked out just wonderful. It couldn't be a more perfect voice.
When filming this, What did you two learn about the queer community? What did you two learn about the evangelical Christian community that maybe you were surprised about?
I can maybe one thing that always sticks out for me, I mean, because we're queer, you know, we sort of in a way you naturally fit into the queer community there, right? So personally, I was more surprised by aspects of the evangelical community that I didn't really expect. In one case, Randall Christie, who owns the Great Passion Play, I was talking with him about when we first started to work down there. We were sort of adamant about not representing him and his congregation and what the Passion Play does in any sort of way that was obvious. We were more interested in seeing, like, going a little deeper and seeing if there was anything there that we could, you know, sort of mine. And we had just recently seen, you know, say, there was just some interviews on television that had sort of placed him in, like, an obviously negative light. And I asked him about it. He said, well, it's simple because, you know, when you know that somebody is trying to frame you up a certain way, you know that you're supposed to play the role of the villain, and so you do. And I thought that was pretty profoundly, I don't know, I found it to be very media savvy, but at the same time I thought, why? Why is this media savvy exist here? What's richer about this person and their belief system that I'm not perhaps taking into account initially because of my own bias?
What do you think it is in about Eureka that made it a community that was built up like this? Certainly there are a lot of other small towns in the South and a lot of very Christian towns in the South. Did you get a sense of why the community chose Eureka?
It's kind of a classic story. It's the same story as the Castro in San Francisco, where the town was languishing. It was cheap. It was away from the mainstream life in the 60s and 70s, and hippies and artists and queers just moved to this town because they could. And it was especially in the South, to get away from urban centers, there's a new look happening at the growth of rural queer life, which has been kind of overshadowed by urban queer studies for a long time. And Eureka and towns like it that exist everywhere are part of that kind of migration of queers that weren't that's not usually recognized. And we tried very hard to get the story into the film, but there's already a lot going on in the film, so it did. That information is stuff that we're trying to put in the public now so people can think about these stories.
You mentioned that although there is a very large queer community there, one area that's particularly grown is the trans community in Eureka Springs. And I think in the last 5 or so years, that's one community that has really increased their visibility, whether it's through people like Laverne Cox or the Wachowskis. And yet there's still a lot of misconceptions about the trans community. What did you learn about that community, that sub-community of the queer community that perhaps people get wrong? What did you learn about them when making this film?
That's a big question. I can speak to about it in relationship to Eureka, which is that there is in many urban communities, there's still a sort of gender divide I see playing out within trans communities, you know? And in places like Eureka, or I think maybe the South in general, where the danger is higher and the oppression is stronger on a daily basis, not to take away from the danger and oppression that any person in a trans community faces. But there, it's intense and it's in your face. trans community across gender lines that, like, in a way that is happening faster and in with more strength than it might be happening in urban centers.
Out of all the characters that we see in the film, do you have a favorite storyline that you felt came together while shooting it or perhaps in post?
Well, I mean, it's hard to play a favorite because, you know, it really did become close with all of these people, but I think Lee and Walter was a very special relationship, and we don't really want to give away my film, but I think that was definitely a favorite for me.
Yeah, me and Walter, the owners of the bar, and they became, you know, friends. And when you look at their past, they're quite heroic in my book. With that became a very personal friendship of all the fall subjects and films. But I do want to point a little attention. I think that the character of Jamie, who is the Christian T-shirt shop owner, he's challenging a lot of stereotypes about straight white men in the South with his openness and his beliefs and his willing to question things. And I hope that people, you know, this film is very clear and you know, it's getting a lot of attention on that front. But I hope people can walk away thinking about him and this is a white man in the South who's gently asking questions about his faith and the positions that it puts him in the world. So I think he deserves a shout out.
I want to pick up on that because, you know, with all the media's coverage on different communities and all the activism that's happening, the South has always been one area where people, I think, have their own ideas and stereotypes and prejudices about. In the course of making this film and meeting all these characters, what do you think society and the media gets wrong about people from the South, and in particular the white Christians who populate it?
I think the image is sort of a community that are, you know, a group of people that are not very bright, not very self-aware, and not very open to changing their own position. And these are the kind of preconceptions that are used against anyone, you know, to keep any person out of their self-awareness and power. And I think that it's hard to be sympathetic, especially in this day and age under this president. It's really hard to be sympathetic to conservative Christians. But we always, like, we went into the film thinking, if we're going to respect the way that our queer characters and our progressive characters redefine their faith, it would be hypocritical of us to be any less respectful and investigative of the conservative side. And I think people have to understand that all people are very complicated. Don't ever believe that simplistic stereotype that's parlayed to you. You know, even if the person you consider your enemy, you're stronger for knowing the complexities of your enemy than by an illusory weakness.
You mentioned that, we talked about the stereotypes and whatever, but interestingly, generationally, a lot of the younger generations are less religious and more tolerant of previous generations. So what do you, you know, yes, the film can have an impact now, but perhaps, you know, 10, 15, 20 years down the road when there isn't maybe this as big of a divide, where do you think this film will fit in perhaps the cultural history of our time?
I don't think that our culture is ever going to be a place where everybody gets along, and I think there will always be people who misrepresent the sort of basic tenets of, you know, the golden rule, you know, or the basic story of the Bible, whether you believe it or not, the teachings of Jesus are, it's basically love, right? There's always going to be haters. So, you know, I think the film will be just fine if, you know, in that way, I guess.
You know, in your director's statement,
you seem to be imagining like a world where, you know, there was no division anymore, and I it's so funny because I'm wondering if, like, God, am I just so blasted that I can't see that anymore ever again because of the administration we live under? But in reality, yes, it's very stark, and the differences are very stark that people are feeling here in the United States. But that will pass. But I still think there will be these arguments going on and interpretations of the Bible going on for eternity, for as long as that religion lasts. You know, we were hoping to... What's that?
No, sorry, continue, yeah.
Oh, yeah, we were just hoping to, you know, to sort of dip into this conversation that was being had amongst Christians who had huge differences, you know, at this particular point in time. But I think they're going to constantly have to.
Well, I was going to say, you know, given everything that's happened under the presidency and in your government right now, do you think this film would have had the same type of impact it's having now had we had a different president, like Obama or Hillary, or maybe a more left-leaning president?
Well, we started this film under the, you know, understanding that Hillary Clinton was going to be the next president of the United States, without question. It was bizarre to be down there and to be having conversations with people who convinced Trump was going to win. And you just sort of take that in. But, you know, as we all know, like, that was not the dominant narrative of how things were supposed to turn out. But, and I'll let Donald pick up on this because he also wants to say something about it. But I don't think the specific politics of who won the election, to some degree, I think it definitely works to our advantage, you know, because now there's so much divisiveness and we're, this community is the community that's trying to figure things out. So, but we certainly didn't expect that to occur. We expected Clinton to be president, you know, but it didn't change the way we were approaching this at all.
But if I can add to that, I think if things had gone better, then I think the essential optimistic message that is in the film would still have an impact because the struggles that we're trying to put a little hope into would still be happening. However, kind of, you know, to follow up what Mike's saying, like, I feel there's a bit, the comedy that we brought to the issues in the film, I think there's a bigger need for it now than there might have been otherwise. You know, the film has more, it has more political purpose, or a broader political purpose maybe, than it would have under a different administration.
You mentioned how, you know, sometimes it might be difficult to show sympathy, you know, for with the conservatives, but as documentary filmmakers and, you know, as people who are telling mostly nonfiction true stories, where is the challenge of you guys to make sure that your biases don't seep into your work at all, and that you just want, and the, you just need to show the story like it is? How difficult is that? How early in the process for you were you guys able to do that?
The lucky thing for us is that all across the film you have such vibrant human beings, you know, and the characters and the basic material, you know, of the film resisted. Where we were angry, the film was always asking to be gentle, and it was sometimes, yes, frustrating because you wanted to make a harder political statement, but, you know, the film just didn't want that. The film always played better and spoke better and revealed its complexities if we stayed back from direct political weaponry, or I don't know, you know, tried to politicize the film too much.
What do you want audiences, whether they're queer audiences, Christian audiences, somewhere in between, what do you want them to take away when they see this documentary?
I think just you know, that it's not a simple picture. Faith is not a simple picture. And under the right circumstances, what can be essentially a divisive system is also a system that can bring a community together. And we should think about all these things, especially on a daily basis when we're trying to be divided on every front.
Well, the film is The Gospel of Eureka. Michael Palmieri, Donald Mosher, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alrighty, have a good day. Cheers.
Me too. Bye-bye.
That was my conversation with Michael Palmieri and Donald Mosher. Their new film, Gospel of Eureka, is out now. That does it for me today. We're going to take you out with one more song from Grace LaChance off her new album, When Lightning Strikes. This is her latest single, Strong. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.
Doesn't mean I'm gonna have to listen.